Thank you, Jerry, for agreeing to be interviewed for it today. And today is September the 3rd, 2014. And again, Karen Brewster is here and Leslie McCartney. And Jerry, can you state your full name? I don't know your last name.
My name is Gerald Pete. I go by Jerry.
Well, thank you very much. And of course, Ed and Roger are still in the room too. And Jerry's wife,
Phyllis.
Thank you. So we'll start again just with some loose biographical information, Jerry, about where you're from and how you came to be in the military.
Okay, I grew up around Popejoy in Alden, Iowa. Attended Alden School, graduated from Alden High School, and worked for summer at a packing plant, and was drafted. Went down to Fort Bliss, Texas, or to Fort Wainwright, Missouri for basic training, and then was told that I would probably be going into radio repair at that time, and be a radio operator. And when it came time to leave Fort Leonard Wood, my orders weren't there. So I sat at Fort Leonard Wood for about 2 weeks waiting for orders. When they finally came down, they sent me down to Fort Bliss, Texas, for training on the Nike missiles. And I went into the program as a maintenance is actually a non-com position.
It's non-commissioned?
Non-commissioned officer position. I was responsible. The training there was dealing with the missiles themselves and the launching equipment. So I was maintaining launching equipment, assembling it, maintaining and assembling the missiles and warheads to the missiles, etc. So that was primarily the training that I got down there.
And what year were you drafted and you went into this training?
I was drafted in 1966, May of 1966, and ended up down at Fort Bliss that fall.
Did you have radio experience before?
Why I had absolutely no experience with radio or
so. How did they? Why did they choose you for that?
Just the battery of tests that you take when you go into basic training. They pretty well isolate, you know, what kind of a knowledge background you've got, what you're capable of picking up, I guess. And use that to determine where they're going to stick you, where the needs are.
So unlike Roger and Ed, who we spoke to, who slowly found out that these were nuclear missiles, you must have known right off the bat.
Our training down at Fort Bliss, we were informed that they were, some of the missiles were nuclear missiles. How that affected me, I can't say that it really did at that time. I was a little naive about it at that point, so didn't think much about it.
How old were you at that point?
I was 19, or no, be 20 at that time.
So you didn't really understand the gravity of...
Not really.
Right.
All I knew was that, you know, I was in for 2 years. I had a job that I had to do. I'll do the job.
Right.
And that's about as far as I thought about it.
Didn't think about the danger.
Didn't think about it at all. No.
So take us through one of your regular days.
Well, after I was got up to Alaska, up to Fairbanks, and got out on the missile site. My typical day, as these guys said, You had formation, cleaned the barracks. Each group had certain areas that they were responsible for, so you took care of those areas. And then after formation, then we went down, climbed on the Deuce and a Half, went down to the launching area, which is about two and a half miles down the valley from the fire control area where our barracks were. We went into the, my duties were in the assembly building primarily. Went in, depending on what we were doing that day, it would vary greatly because when I first got there, my responsibility was to learn the, they had a test set there that they checked the missiles with, the gauge systems on the missiles. And I was responsible for learning that test system. We had learned it a little bit in school, but not totally. So I had to relearn that system. And once we relearned that system, then on our day-to-day basis, as we would bring a missile in, or ordnance would bring a missile to the site, we would take it into the assembly building, and we would pull it out of the crates, actually assemble the missile without the warhead and without the booster. So we'd put the missile together. We would take this RF test set and actually test the missile guidance system, make sure that the guidance system worked properly, that the elevons on the missiles responded correctly, and that we're, our response would come back from the missile. So basically what we were doing was checking the missile to make sure that it would talk to the fire control radar or the fire control systems and respond to them and then send signals back to them so that they would communicate back and forth. After we assembled the missile, then we would take it to what they called the warhead building. And at that point, we would assemble the warhead onto the missile. It was actually, the guidance system was the tip of the missile, and you had a warhead, and then the rest of the missile, the motor and avions and so on, were behind that. So we actually separated the two sections that we had already put together, put the warhead in, fastened everything together, and connected all the wiring. That was when things started getting hairy for me, because safety was the first thing that they stressed on everything. the rocket motor was also put in the warhead building because of the high explosives in the rocket motor. So it was actually inserted into the missile and put together in there. Once that was all put together, then the missile itself was transported down to the what we called the section. We had two sections in the launching area. Went down to the section and was put onto a launcher where it was also attached to the booster. Once it was on the launcher and fastened to the frame and everything, everything was checked out again, and then it was put into the section for storage and for use later on. So that was a typical scenario of what went on down there. Now, day to day, I didn't assemble a missile every day. We didn't have to. They really didn't have that many missiles. But periodically, the missiles had to be pulled apart, brought back, disassembled, and warheads removed. The rocket motors were removed, and the missile itself went back to the assembly building to be thoroughly checked over again to make sure that everything was still functioning properly. And at that time, the ordnance people would come in and do tests on the motor and on the warhead to make sure that there were not any cracks in the housing on the motor or the warhead, which would explode prematurely when the missile was launched. So that was kind of what I did.
Well, that asked me a lot of questions.
Yes.
First of all, how did the missiles get to Fairbanks?
I can't really tell you that.
Okay.
Because all I know is we saw them come in from ordnance, from Fort Wainwright. They'd truck them in with an armed escort, of course, and bring them to the site. And once they were at the site, then we took possession and assembled and so on.
I guess the same question for, you know, how did the warheads get
right,
there?
Right, same way.
Same way.
Right.
So I was just curious when you were saying about, what are the boosters? What powers the boosters? What's in there?
It's high explosives.
Mm-hmm.
It's a solid rocket fuel that they used in the boosters. There were actually four cylinders that were fastened together in a square. So we had actually four rocket motors on the booster. When the missile was fired, it would fire the booster. The booster would push the missile up. When it reached its proper elevation, the booster would separate, and the rocket motor on the missile itself was then activated and go on downrange. So that's basically what we were dealing with.
So how often would you then take these missiles apart to check everything?
They were not taken apart. I think every couple of years or so they had to be tested. I'm not sure of the exact sequence, but we did several while I was there. And like I said, I was there a little over a year also.
Mm-hmm. That was my question. Yeah, so when did you go to Fairbanks?
I went in, arrived in Fairbanks in March of 1967 and left in April of 68.
Mm-hmm. And so Ed and Roger had talked about they'd had this training at Fort Bliss or wherever, and then they got to battery A, am I correct?
Or A battery.
A battery.
Right.
And it was not quite what they had been trained in.
Right.
What was your experience with that?
My experience was that the training that I had in Fort Bliss was pretty much what I was doing when I got to Fairbanks, to the missile site, mm-hmm. to A battery. So it was pretty much the same training. My situation, I stepped into a E-6 position when I came in, and I was a private E-1 when I got there. So my problem wasn't so much that, you know, I was dealing with training. My problem was that I was a grunt soldier coming into a non-com position, and needless to say, that caused a little bit of stress. Some of the other guys didn't appreciate that.
And why did that happen?
They needed somebody in that position. They were short on assembly people, and all over the country. It wasn't just Alaska. But they were short on assembly people that would qualify to be able to work and actually assemble the missiles and be responsible for that. So that was where I had a problem. Because, like these guys, I was drafted. I did not like authority as well. And here I am in a position where I have to be the authority, and I didn't like it. So.
And did guys under you give you trouble?
No, not really. When I first got there, they stuck me in the, when I went into the barracks, of course, I came in middle of the night, at night, so I was put into the Bay Area, I guess they called it, where all of the low-ranking men were bunking. Mm-hmm. I was put in with them. The next night, after I had checked in with the first officer, or first sergeant, they moved me to a non-commissioned room. And some of the guys didn't appreciate that. They didn't think that was fair. So caused a little stigma there. Most of the guys that I became acquainted with right away were the guys that worked in the sections, because even though I was in assembly, we used section people to help with the assembly and so on, because once I got down in the sections, then they took over the maintenance of those missiles as far as the day-to-day checks and so on the missiles.
So it helped if they knew how they were put together.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So as far as other things I did, we were responsible for, of course, when we had HOT status, we had to, the position I was in was as a fire control officer position, if there wasn't an officer on site in the launching area. That was my responsibility. It was to become the launching control officer. So when we had drills, then I was the one that had to be in charge of the launching area. Even though I was a PF or a private, I had E6 sergeants reporting to me from the sections. And it's kind of an awkward situation to be in. So it was not very fun at times.
Can I just go back to what you were saying about the safety and when things got really hairy, putting things together?
Right.
So did it? How did that work? Was there a two-system check where, you know, before you put that wire in there, someone's going to say, yes, that's where it should go?
Before we connected any wire on a missile, mm-hmm. we actually took a voltmeter and checked the pin continuity and checked the continuity between every pin on that connector before we connected it. Mm. If it didn't give us the correct reading, it was not connected. And we had to go back and find out why that reading was not right. And I don't think we ever found any that weren't right, so we didn't have to ever actually send them a warhead or a rocket motor or anything back to ordnance to be further checked. But
that sounds pretty scary and stressful to me.
Right. It's just that, you know, we had the procedure down. You checked every single wire on that missile every time you connected something.
So did you find it scary or?
At times it was. The thing that we were really careful about was you're using wrenches to tighten bolts on the missile, screwdrivers, etc. And we had a procedure anytime you were using a wrench, and it was a rule, and if you got caught breaking it, it was major consequences. You never push your wrench. You always pulled a wrench. And the reason for that was that if you're pushing a wrench and that wrench slips off the bolt and hits the missile, there's a possibility of a spark. And we've got high explosives here. Sparks and high explosives don't mix. So you always pulled it. If you pulled it and it slipped off, you had control. You'd stop right there. Whereas if you're pushing, you know, it slips, you're going to hit something. So that was major.
So there was concern. Five really tight procedures for handling
yes.
and assembling.
Right. Mm-hmm. In the launching area, there was never a person working on a missile by themselves. Okay, there was always two men. That was a rule. Any time that you were in an area where the missile was, or where the warhead was, or the rocket motors were, you always had two men there.
And when you were actually assembling them, how many people worked on it at the same
time? There was a crew of probably six or seven men working on it. It varied from time to time because sometimes we could use the extra help, and we did. We had a forklift operator that lifted the crates for the motor and the warhead, brought those into the assembly building. We had the person or the sergeant that was in charge of, and usually there was a warrant officer there that was in charge of the operation, and then there were the people doing the work. I was the primary person doing the attaching, and then we had two or three other people that were doing some of the other things, connecting and so on. I usually had to do most of the testing. And the way we did that, we would go into the manual. We had a manual there, and the person reading the manual would call off a wire number and or a pin number on the wire, usually two pin numbers, and we'd call off what we were reading on those pin numbers. And he would give us a check or a no to determine whether that was correct or not, just for safety reasons. So.
And then out in the launch site itself,
okay.
Did you have an assembly of anything out there?
Once the missile was on the launcher, mm-hmm. Okay, most of the maintenance done there was done by the section hands. There was a sergeant down there that was in charge of each section. And then he had a crew of probably 15 or 20 men. And it varied from day to day who it was. They weren't all in the section at the same time, but they did the routine main day-to-day checking. They would pull hatches off missiles, have to check certain things. A lot of those tests I'd have to go down with to the sections and verify that they were done properly. Same type thing where we would check connectors, so on. And we'd do that on a routine basis. When we did simulations, which we did quite often, we'd go in, we'd put... first of all, a warhead was never, the wiring for the warhead, to fire the warhead, was never connected on a missile unless it was being ready to fire.
So unless you were under hot time?
We would have to be under hot status, and only when we were told that that missile was prepared to be prepared for firing.
And
would we connect that?
How long would that take you to prepare?
Just a couple minutes.
That fast.
Yeah, you'd pull a panel off, You would check the pins on the wires, connect the wires, put the panel back on.
Right.
And then you'd get an indicator on your test panel. There was a test panel in the section itself, and of course you had a series of lights and switches and everything had to be checked and everything, and you'd get an indication that the warhead was armed, that you knew that it was ready. So then at that point, then the missile was raised on the launcher and prepared to fire. The personnel would go back into the section. The doors were closed. The van, in the van, launching control van, we would be in there. We'd have an indicator there that the missile was hot and ready to be fired. And then we'd get commands from fire control as to elevation, azimuth, and range. And we'd have to send those from the launching control trailer to the section hands. They would set those parameters in. When we verified that those parameters were set in the launching control trailer, we notified fire control, the missile is hot, azimuth and everything is in, has been set, we're ready to fire. And then we wait for command to fire. We had a switch there that when we received the command to fire, then we flipped the switch to fire that missile. So.
And then to, if you had to, I don't know what the right word is, when you went from hot back to normal, then you had to unconnect all the wiring for the warhead?
The missile would be lowered.
Right.
First thing that would happen would be the panel would be pulled off, those wires would be disconnected, and the rocket motor would be disconnected.
Okay.
So that there would be no accidental firing.
Right.
Panels were put back on, the missile was put back into the section,
mm-hmm.
and if it was one that was housed on, kept on the launcher, then stayed on the launcher. If it was a missile that was, we had rails that ran between the launchers also. If it was a missile that was kept on the rail, then it would be moved to its position for storage.
So you kept some missiles on a launcher at all times?
There was a missile on every launcher at all times.
But not activated unless you were under the hot situation.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Now, when we did simulations, we had a dummy plug that we put plugged into the missile. And it would give us the simulation that the missile was hot. And we would go ahead and hook that up, go through the same scenario as if we were going to fire the missile. And then we'd raise the missile. Fire control then would lock onto the missile and make sure that they could control it. They were getting response from the missile. And then we'd simulate a fire, and that'd be it.
Did you actually ever send up missiles? Well, we talked about that a little bit.
Every year we had to launch one. We went over to B Battery when I was there. We actually assembled the missile, took it out of the boxes, assembled it, raised it. Unfortunately, the day that we were there, it was snowing like crazy. And we raised the missile. After the assembly crew was done, then everyone that was not needed for firing the missile in the launching area was removed from the launching area and went up to the fire control area. And they had bleachers set up where we could watch the launch. What we saw when they launched the missile was we heard this roar, and we saw the snow all of a sudden clear, and we saw the tail end of some fire coming down as this missile went up. And that's all we saw. And the snow closed in, and we hear this missile going downrange. So that was the gist of what we saw.
Did the cold affect the launch pads at all, or the launch
equipment? Yeah, it did. It did. We had to constantly check that equipment because of the cold. Occasionally, we had to replace parts on the launchers. The missiles themselves were housed in a heated, and the sections were heated, so they weren't affected as much, but the launchers themselves were, because they were actually outside.
But you did say you had some missiles on those launchers.
Well, they were on a rail that the launcher moved out on.
Oh, I see.
Okay.
So the launcher would be in a building on a rail.
Launcher's in a building on the rail. It moved out.
Okay.
Okay, but you had to make sure that that track that it moved on was clear of all the snow and ice and everything that came up. So it was a constant battle to make sure that was clear and make sure that that launcher was going to function properly. Like I said, there was rails running between the launchers also on the outside as well as on the inside of the section. So those rails had to be maintained as well, because if we had to bring a missile out and move it over and then go back in and pull another missile out, for instance, if we had a high explosive missile on the launcher and we needed to or we were instructed to put a nuclear missile, whether low or high or high powered, on that launcher, then we had to get that high explosive round off the launcher. And the way we did that, we moved it out, moved that to the side of the launcher on the rails outside, took the launcher back in, and they brought that nuclear missile onto the launcher, brought it out, moved it off, moved the high explosive onto the launcher, put it in, moved it to the side, brought the launcher back out, put the nuclear round on the launcher, and then went through our procedure.
What machine is moving this around, or was this all mechanical?
It's the launchers themselves had, I'm not sure whether it was a cable that pulled them out or whether it was actual, I think it was a cable if I remember right, that actually pulled the launcher out. It's a cable system that went out, around, and back. So they were actually pulled out, pulled back in. But they were electric motors that actually moved them.
So no fear of, hopefully, sparks or anything like that? Like,
no.
There was no gas engines around?
No.
Then I think the cold would be an effect on you guys. You know, see, the radar guys were in a heated building.
Right.
You guys were out in the elements.
I wasn't out in it as much as the section guys were. The section guys were out there a lot more than I was, because I was on the assembly end of it, and we were always, when we were working on the missiles, we were most usually in the buildings. The only time that I was out in it was when we were actually testing the launching equipment, the actual launchers or the test sets, control sets for the launchers. They were outside. So they had to be checked periodically, too.
Just to go back to what we were kind of briefly talking about with Ed and Roger, and you mentioned that there was different color codes or different levels of nuclear warheads.
Right.
So can you maybe explain that? Because I have something I don't know about.
Well, basically there were two sizes of nuclear warheads. There was a large, or what they called a high-powered nuclear warhead, and there was a low-powered. I can't tell you exactly what the specs on that was, because they didn't tell us. But they were, the way we could tell the difference was the color of the markings on the warhead itself. And I can't remember at this time what those colors were or anything else.
I think red was the big one.
I don't remember.
What was the other color right here?
I don't
color on the warheads. Red was the large
stripes.
Yeah. Stripe about that long.
Yeah. And I don't remember what they were.
I think red
was the black stripe for AGs.
That might be. I don't remember really.
A yellow or a green stripe for something else.
Mm. Yes. Just a little or field.
Yeah.
Red was the big one.
Red was the big one. That would make
that
sense.
That would make sense. Yeah. Red.
But you had mentioned being the, what was the word? It was not the fire control operator. Is that, yeah, the fire control officer.
Mm-hmm.
So is that the person who makes the final decision to push the button?
That's made by higher
authority. Okay, so I should rephrase it. That's the person who pushes the button to launch it
when he's been told to do it.
I was the launcher guy.
Right.
That has, I have to flip a switch in the launching control trailer that allows the missile to be launched.
Mm-hmm.
Now, fire control also has a switch up there, if I remember right, that had to be activated also before it could be launched.
So again, the two-tier system of double check.
Right. And then once both those switches are activated, then I believe the computer took over. I'm not real sure how that worked up there, but then it went. Fire control took control of it at that point.
So you, at the launch site, just by pushing that button, didn't shoot the missile off. There was one more layer.
Right.
Above
you. Yep.
And of course, you couldn't flip the switch until you had received orders to do so.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. If I had, nothing would have happened. Other than I'd probably gotten court-martialed.
So it started from the battery control.
Right.
We then sent it down to you and then back and forth.
Yep.
It could be launched from your van if they could not from BC for some technical problem.
Right.
So there
was a way that we could launch it from the battery control trailer.
There was a drill, I think, from one of the guys in our reunions. He was in a drill where he actually fired it from the launcher area.
Yeah.
I don't remember if it was an actual firing or if it was a
drill. So how would that work? How could you fire it from the launch area?
We had an override that we could activate, but it had to come down as a verbal command from fire control to activate that. I couldn't just, and there's another man in the trailer also. I'm not the only one in the trailer.
Mm-hmm.
So there had to be verification on his part before I could activate that.
So you still had the checks and balances. It was just overriding the switch.
Right. Yep.
And then were there follow-up reports, like every day? Did you have to file reports every time you did something?
We didn't down there. Now, or not that I was involved in anyhow. I'm sure there were reports that had to be filed and everything, but I had a sergeant above me, actually two sergeants above me, and a warrant officer that was responsible for that paperwork and so on.
That's a big responsibility, being the one that flips a switch, even though you get the orders.
Yeah.
How did that affect you, or did you really consciously think about it?
Yes, no. I went up through the ranks so fast that, I mean, my head was in a blur most of the time. I went from a private E1 to a specialist E5 as soon as I could get time and rank. At one point there, I had three different insignias on my uniforms because I didn't have time to change them all before I was promoted again. And then as soon as I made E5, they took me over to headquarters on Fort Wainwright, and I was promoted to acting Sergeant E5. So I was actually in a non-com position. I had the authority of a non-com, non-commissioned officer, just that quick. And here I am. I'm still green.
So how was it that you were able to move through the ranks so quickly?
Because I was in an E6 position, and they had to fill that position as soon as they could. And since they didn't have a sergeant to fill that position, they had to bring somebody up through the ranks to fill it. And since there was such a shortage of assembly personnel, that's the only thing they could do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you must have been capable.
Well, that was debatable.
IFC area is entirely different rank ways.
Yeah.
You didn't get promotions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He and I both walked out as a specialist sports class just very shortly before we were discharged that we did that. Right. And that's why a lot of the guys did stay in and then jumped there too, as there was no rank.
Yeah. Most of the launching area was that way too.
Yeah.
But I just happened to be in that position where it was an E6 position.
So you're saying most of the people on post didn't get to be promoted. They just stayed there.
They were promoted, but they were promoted at a normal cycle. You know, they had to have time and rank, and then it may be, you know, for instance, a private coming in as a section hand may be a private for 6 months or a year before he's promoted to private E2.
So in the 18 months or 2 years, you're not going to get very far in the normal?
Not normally.
Specialist
four. No, maybe specialist four. Okay. And then that's, you have to be in a specialist position. The section hands probably would not have made E4.
So was there a hierarchy within you had more status if you were working at the launch versus a section hand versus the radar guys?
I think we pretty much worked together. We didn't associate a lot with the fire control area because the guys up there, because we were in separate areas.
Mm-hmm. You know, like each other.
2 miles apart.
Well, you were in barracks and mess hall together.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you also have the 24 hours on and then 8 hours off? Was your schedule different?
Our schedules were usually, we'd go down in the morning and come back that evening. Okay, if we were on hot status, we were on 24 on, 24 off, similar to what you guys were. But because of the situation down there where we're in the cold a lot, we weren't running these long hours like those guys were. We tried to stay out of the cold as much as we could and do as much inside.
So a lot
of our work was inside.
So you're 24 hours on, if it was a hot status and you were 24 hours on,
right,
were you down at the launch site that
whole 24
hours?
We had to
hours?
Stay in the launching area during that period of time.
And
right?
So was there places for you guys to sleep, and how did you get
food? We had bunks down there, and they shuttled food down from the barracks to our facility down there. We actually had bunks in the assembly building and a kitchen down there where they served the food.
So the job that you did obviously wasn't one that you could tell people what you did.
No.
And how long was it before you could really talk about your role?
I never really talked about it much until we started having these reunions. First one of these that I went to.
With us.
Yeah.
Was there were you guys told, you know, you can't talk about this obviously while you're working there, but like for the next 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, or was it that structured?
You were told that this is a secret installation, mm-hmm. and you were not to talk about it to anyone. There were certain things that you could say, you know, Nike Hercules is X number of feet long and it has a booster. As far as any technical aspects of that missile, you can talk about that.
Definitely not about a warhead.
No.
Well,
no. We had, from time to time, we had a civil engineer, or civil, not civil engineer, the civil aeronautics club would come, and we would actually bring, we had a training missile that we used. It was looked like a regular missile, except the warhead in it and the rocket motor in it were empty. There was nothing in them. And we used that as a training missile to train new section personnel. So we would bring that outside the fence of the launching area, and the Civil Aeronautics Club would come in, and we would actually show them the missile, explain a little bit how the missile worked as far as we could, what we were allowed to say about it, and then that was it. So some civilians were able to see it and get a little brief explanation of how it worked. But that was about as far as we went, or we were allowed to even talk about it.
I was wondering, you know, that on your days off, if you went into town, let's say you went into Fairbanks and, you know, you went to a restaurant or a bar, or you're talking about, oh, you know, what do you say about
I was I was a little different than anybody else around there, because I always went to church. We were stationed just down the road, about, 5 miles from North Pole. Mm-hmm. And I went to a little Baptist church down there at North Pole. So I got acquainted with some of the people from Eielson Air Force Base and some of the local people, and became friends with some of them. And I used to go down there. Well, of course, went to church every Sunday, Wednesday nights. So I got off base for that. Because I became familiar with or got acquainted with these people, a lot of times we'd go and do things together. I went to, they had some dog sled races, stuff like that. We went out and watched those one time. Went out to Eielson, Eielson Air Force Base, and watched a bunch of people skiing out there, you know, stuff like that, you know, odd and end stuff. One couple I was acquainted with was an airman at the Air Force Base, but they lived in North Pole. And so we went out and cut down a Christmas tree at Christmas time. Mm-hmm. And helped them set up the Christmas trees, you know, stuff like that. I would also go into Fairbanks. We go in bowl, go skating, stuff like that.
So did you have were you given a script? If someone said, so what do you do? Did the Army supply you with a script, or was it
no. You
were to make up your own?
I don't think anyone has really asked me what I did.
They just knew you were with the Army.
They would know I was in the Army. They might ask, well, what do you do in the Army? Well, I'm stationed on a missile site out here. Oh, okay. That was about the extent of...
But you could say that, I'm stationed on a missile site.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Yep.
So people in the area knew those sites were there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
They maybe didn't know what was going on there.
Right.
They knew they were there.
Yep.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things that happened when I was there was I was up there in 67, and they had the big flood in Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. And during the flood, of course, Fort Wainwright was flooded also. And most of our officers and non-commissioned officers lived on Fort Wainwright, so they couldn't get out to the site. Not that they didn't want to or whatever, but they just weren't able to get out there. So we weren't allowed to leave the site during that period of time, except for me. I was the only one that got off site.
How'd you sneak out?
And no, it wasn't a matter of sneaking out. I went to the officer in charge. I said, I always go to church on Sunday. I says, I'd like permission to leave the site, go to church. He says, go right ahead. But I was the only one that ever got off that site during the flood.
So given where, at least where Ed and Roger were located, which is now part of the floodplain,
mm-hmm.
did the water come anywhere near any of the Nike site? It didn't.
No.
We were high enough up.
Yeah. We were nowhere near.
Definitely where that was way up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the barracks themselves, if you're familiar with North Pole, mm-hmm. If you go east on Richardson Highway, there's a big mound on the north side of the road there. Our fire control area sat up on top of that mound.
Through the Moose Creek Bluff up there?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And then the launching area is straight north of there, about 2.5 miles down in the valley.
Mm.
But we weren't anywhere near the river. Mm. That whole area to the south of of Richardson Highway there, that was all water. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could see it from the bluff there. And you look toward Fairbanks, and you can see the water out that way also. So,
were there times where in the launch area you were told, okay, this is it, get everything ready, get it activated, ready to fire? There wasn't a test that actually got that close?
I don't recall that we'd ever had any where we actually were put a missile up for, or prepared a missile for firing.
Other than when you were in a hot time.
Well, even when we were in a hot time, we didn't.
Oh, right, because you had to assemble it all first.
Because
right.
It had to be assembled. But we did have routine tests. You know, we'd have drills where headquarters would set up a drill, and we'd have to go through the whole process and simulate launching the missile. And we did do that several times while I was up there.
Yeah, I wondered if things ever got to a point that, okay, we see something on the radar, we're trying, here we go, guys, ready to go.
Yeah.
And then at the last minute, oh, no, never mind.
No.
No.
Not to my knowledge.
Because I think that would be pretty stressful.
Yeah. We had never gotten to the point where we actually had to pull a missile out and set it up for firing.
Mm-hmm. So you were only up there. How did the winters affect you then, personally?
Well, personally, it was pretty good. We were required to go out on bivouac during the winter.
Well, now they remember
too. Yeah. You had to go out, and I'm not sure how long it was supposed to be. I think it was it was just overnight.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we loaded up our gear the morning that we were supposed to go out on bivouac. Went down to the bivouac area, unloaded the gear, and we were supposed to set up our tents and so on. Well, before I ever got that far, first sergeant came down. He said, "Pete, go down to the launching area. They need you down there." Okay, what do you want me to do afterwards? Come back out here. Okay. So I went down to the launching area for the day. It was a normal day down in the launching area. Well, at the end of the day, I go back out to the bivouac area. Get out there. I say, well, you're not set up yet, so take your gear and go back up to the barracks. So I loaded up my gear and went up to the barracks. There was a lieutenant down there that told me to do that. He had his pickup down there. He says, "Take my pickup, load up your gear, and go to the barracks. Stay there."
Gotta follow orders, right?
Followed orders. So I never did.
Interesting scenario on the winter indoctrination.
Yeah.
We went out. Generally, and I assume it worked the same for you, the one group went out and set up the tents and did everything, and then you left, and then the other group would come for the next day, and they would take tents down. We were on the first group. We went out, we set up the tents, and there we got, we got heat in the tents and everything, and it got to be quite late in the day. And the temperature got colder than they figured it was supposed to get. Some colonel at Wainwright says, "You got to get them guys out of there." Well, everybody's in their sleeping bags and in their tent, and they're very comfortable. They don't want to leave.
but they left anyway. But the best part about it was, we were supposed to, you know, we were the second group. We were supposed to pick things up, but we had duty. Well, somebody else had to go pick up the stuff.
I don't really know who did. No idea who went and did it.
Yeah, have no idea who went and did it, but somebody got drafted to go out.
They got
the,
I think it was
up.
64 below or something that night, and if it was colder than 50 below, you weren't supposed to be there, no. I think.
So how did you get out to this big boat? Did you snowshoe out, or you just drove
took
out?
Us in trucks.
They took us out in a deuce and a half.
A deuce and a half? What's
yeah,
that?
It's a 2.5-ton truck.
Oh, okay. A deuce and a half.
Right.
So you were there for a year, you said?
Yeah, just a little over a year.
And then what?
Then it was my tour of duty was up, so... I went home. I had considered staying in Alaska, but hadn't been home for over a year and decided that I'd go home first.
So at the time, and then on reflection, you know, how positive, negative in the road?
I had a lot of fun while I was in Alaska. Like I said, I had a lot of friends that were off base. And I actually had a lot of friends on the site, too. My biggest problem was because I went up through the ranks so fast, and supposedly non-coms are not to associate with the enlisted personnel. They're supposed to associate with non-coms. But I just couldn't get by that. I had some non-coms that thought I came up through the ranks too fast, and they didn't appreciate it, and I had the same thing on the other end of enlisted personnel thought I went up too fast. So basically I had a lot of friends that were enlisted personnel that I associated with. We did a lot of things together.
And did you maintain contact with these people afterwards?
No, I lost contact with almost all of them.
But you really liked Alaska.
I enjoyed Alaska. Yeah. I did.
So what did you go on to do after you left the military?
After I got home, went back to work at the packing plant for a while until I decided that that was ridiculous because the union that was supposed to be supporting me was not supporting me, and I told them they could take their job and do what they wanted to with it. And quit. And went back to school, decided that I'd try to get into electronics field. Of course, training for military training is a little different because they train you for what you need to know, and that's it. So my electronics experience was working with a missile. And it's a little different working with a missile than working on TVs and radios. So I went back to school for electronics to learn to work on radios and TVs. Well, when it came time to graduate, I realized that there was a ton of radio TV repairmen out there that were just getting by the skin of their teeth. And it wasn't probably a very good career to get into that area. So I started looking at other options, and there were a lot of people looking for people in the medical field. So had a couple companies that interviewed for and went to work for a company that built particle counters and blood cell counters for hospital laboratories and clinics. Worked for them for 17 years. And got laid off, went to work for a hospital in Cedar Rapids there where I live, and I've been working for them for the last almost 26 years. So
you were still able to use your understanding of electronics and
right.
different equipment, but in a,
right.
a more medical context.
Right.
Neat.
Yep.
So I'm sure you couldn't say in a job interview, you know, what experience do you have? Well, I used to build nuclear missiles.
Well, yeah, you could say you worked on missiles,
right?
Nike Hercules missiles, guided missiles, yeah. And that's about all you ever said,
right?
And they realized that You know, it's a missile and it's military, and you don't ask any more questions. So
in a situation where I interviewed for a job with Sunstrand Aerospace, the guy in the interviewing session turned out to have been a Nike Herc officer, and when he was in the military, so we never said anything other than he knew where I had served and that, but we never talked about it. But I always felt that helped me a great deal in getting a job there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Certainly military experience helps in a lot of contexts,
right,
for getting work afterwards.
Sure. And then the electronics field itself, did you see, you know, you've had both, all of you have had careers in the, how much has that changed? Because my brother used to sit on the bench at fixed radios,
yeah,
and that doesn't exist anymore.
It's changed quite a bit because when I was, well, first of all, the Nike Hercules missile, the guidance system on that was actually vacuum tubes. Okay, believe it or not, it was vacuum tubes. They were little, mm-hmm, tiny ones, but they were vacuum tubes. And when I went back to school, they were still teaching vacuum tubes. And transistors were just getting popular at that time, starting to come out with transistor radios, mm-hmm, and so on. So that's what I was trained on. Well, when I got out of school, of course, the electronics industry was starting to get into integrated circuits and so on, digital circuitry. And so I had to kind of pick that up as I went along. And, so it's changed considerably from what it used to be.
So these vacuum tubes, did they break and you had to keep replacing them? It's not the most
stable system. Well, these were small enough to where you didn't have a lot of problem with them. Occasionally you'd have to replace one, but I can't recall placing more than one or two of them the whole time I was in.
Mm-hmm. And those replacement parts came from ordnance at Fort Wainwright,
right?
Or did you have it on
hand?
Well,
usually what we do is swap out a whole board, circuit board.
Yeah, so did you keep extras of those kinds of things at the site? Or?
Those were brought in by ordnance when we needed them.
Any idea with the missiles, because there's all these different components, were they all the components made somewhere else differently so that nobody really knew what they were making in the factories? Do you know what I mean?
I can't tell you that because I don't know exactly where they were made. One interesting thing that I did run across a couple years ago, I live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and there was an article on the news about this item that was found in a factory, an old factory in Waterloo, Iowa. And they didn't know what it was, but it looked like a bomb. And they brought some people up from Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, to look at this thing. And as it turned out, it was a warhead shell for a Nike Hercules missile that was made in Cedar Rapids or Waterloo, Iowa. And I just about died when I heard this. They had an article in the paper about it.
Did you see the?
I didn't actually see it, no.
Because I said if they'd asked you, you could have told them probably that's what that was.
I may have been able to. Yeah, but I, you know, they wouldn't let anybody anywhere close to it.
No.
So.
That's true.
But it was just kind of an interesting thing that I'd run into later.
Mm-hmm. So, have you been involved in going to all the Nike segments?
This is the third one that I've been to. I was able to go to the one in Dayton and the one in Tucson, and enjoyed both of those. Meeting a lot of the guys. Most of the guys that have been to the reunions have been either fire control area or the MPs, the dog handlers, and haven't been running into too many guys from the launching area, though.
But you're the mystery man who can clear up all the mysteries that everyone wondered what happened in the launch site.
They didn't know what you were doing down there.
Right.
And so what has this meant to you?
I'm proud of what I did. I think that it was something we had to do at the time, and it was well worth it. I think anybody that serves is to be commended for serving, whether they were drafted or whether they enlisted. I don't think it makes any difference. But I wear a hat now. It has U.S. Army on it. And I enjoy it. Mm-hmm. I get comments on it all the time, and people really understand, you know, when I came back from when I came back from Alaska, flew into Des Moines, Iowa, got off the plane, and nobody there to meet me. I had to take a bus from there to my home, and, you know, there's no big fanfare, no even thanks for serving or anything else at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a letdown. I mean, I really felt bad about it at the time. And until, you know, recently when they've started having these honor flights to Washington, D.C. for the World War II vets, mm-hmm. and some of that, and realized that, you know, these guys coming back really need to be appreciated. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really neat when they do that.
Mm-hmm. But it's interesting that, you know, a lot of times the honoring people coming back tends to be people who've been in combat.
Mm-hmm.
You guys weren't in combat.
No.
But you still felt that you weren't honored for your service.
Right.
Yeah. You may not have been in combat, but you were in a very serious situation.
But it was not only true of us.
Yeah.
It's true of the vets that came back from Vietnam.
Well, it's a common story of the vets from Vietnam, and that's why I find interesting that, you know, working at a Nike site was high stress. You didn't see combat, but it was high stress. Mm-hmm. And you did serve.
Right. I've recently joined, not really joined because we didn't sign papers or anything, but I attend meetings of a vets group near several from the Korean War, but mostly they're Vietnam War, and I think there's one from World War II yet. And I always feel funny because they all served in Korea or in Vietnam or in Europe, and I didn't, but still they accept me like I was, you know, a vet from a war as well. So.
Well, I was going to ask Jerry about how you dealt with the stress. I mean, being down on the launching area, I would think would be a little bit more stressful than perhaps some of the other jobs on post.
Well, like I told you earlier, I went to church, and that was a big outlet for me. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've got my faith, and I dealt with that. In fact, I had started a Bible study at the post. Mm-hmm. Bunch of the guys from the launching area would get together on Wednesday nights or whatever and just go in the chapel there. We had a chapel in the barracks. We used to go in there and just have a Bible study. And several of those guys eventually went to church with me from time to time.
Was there a pastor then?
No.
Assigned there? No.
No.
Just a chapel?
Just a chapel, yeah.
But yeah. Wainwright would have had a pastor or something.
Yeah, I'm sure they did down there. But we seldom went to Wainwright. When we had time off, we'd go into Fairbanks. One of the other guys and I had a pickup, so we swapped off whenever who used the truck when, you know. But if we needed to do maintenance on the truck or get gas or anything, we always went to Eielson because it was closer and facilities there were easier to work with than going all the way to Wainwright. So
when you went home, you couldn't really tell your family what you had done? You said it took many years.
Well, you tell them that you're on a missile site, and you know, you maintain missiles. That's about all you could tell them. I mean, what else do you tell them? They wouldn't have understood if I'd have tried to go into detail. Mm-hmm. And since it was a security issue anyhow, you couldn't tell them. Mm-hmm. And so you just never talked about it.
Well, if you said to somebody, well, I worked on a missile site in Alaska, do you feel like people appreciated that? As you said, it was something that had to be done at the time, given the Cold War mm-hmm. situation. Do you think people appreciated, respected that that was happening, or did they go, oh, why do we need those missiles?
I think it was a matter of indifference. You know, they'd ask what you did. Well, I was on a missile site up in Fairbanks, Alaska. Oh, well, that's nice. You know, something to that effect mm-hmm. is what you'd get. Mm-hmm. And you kind of just dropped it at that.
So it sounded like people were accepting that we had these missile sites around the country.
Yeah, they knew they were around. When I was in school, I went out to Chicago to school, and there was actually a missile site that was right there on Lake Michigan, right next to a park, the actual launch area. I don't know where the fire control area was from there, but it was right on the lakefront there, and you could see it. Those missiles were underground, so you seldom saw the missiles. But I recognized the missile site as soon as I saw it.
Right.
I knew what it was. And when I was in training down at Fort Bliss, we had a couple guys there that were from Chicago in the National Guard, and they actually served on those missile sites. Yeah. So I knew they were around. So when I went out there and saw this thing, well, that's the Menike missile site. I know what that is.
Well, just to go back before, when you were maybe not as well on the mic, we were talking about how many missiles there were. Right. Can you maybe tell us that again?
Well, if I remember right, there were 16 missiles per section, and then you had 4 launchers per section. So a total of 16 missiles. 4 of them were always on the launcher, mm-hmm. and the next were on side rails on either side of the launchers in the section building.
That's a lot of missiles.
Yeah,
and there were 5 sites in Alaska each that right. had 16.
Right. Fairbanks.
5.
In Fairbanks.
Oh, 5 just in
Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, right.
And then the 3 here in right. Anchorage.
Yep.
Did you guys ever get down to the Anchorage? Did you ever get down to the Anchorage
no.
one at all? No.
No.
And then there was that one in Anchorage that was a double launcher, right?
I can't tell you.
Okay.
I've heard that there was one with Hertz and Ajaxes. It was a dual site.
There was a dual site. You
learn more of that when you go to King Cape.
Yeah.
I think I read something
yeah.
to that effect. Oh,
there was somebody else we'll talk States. To who worked on one of the sites.
Yeah.
Yeah. So was the site in Alaska bigger than what most sites would be, or was it, or were they all pretty like cookie cutter size everywhere?
I don't know. From what I've read from the materials on the websites and so on, it seems like they were pretty much about the same size. Most of them consisted of 2 sections, although the lower 48, they were all underground, from mm-hmm. what I understand. Whereas these up here are above ground.
Do you know why?
Because of the permafrost.
The other exception was in the Everglades during the Cuban crisis. They moved them down there, and it was just so swampy that they didn't put them.
The Everglades in the Cuban Missile Crisis?
That was the exception, the Florida
yeah.
sites.
Yeah, they'd be above ground too.
Okay. Jerry, anything else that from your experiences that we haven't talked about that you want to make sure we know?
No, I think we pretty well covered it.
Thank you very much. It's been
yeah.
You're welcome.
A really big learning experience.
Yeah, nice to see both sides
right.
yeah.
of what you guys did.
Yeah, I'm glad Jerry
very interesting.
Set in for you.
Yeah,
thank you so
thank
much.
You very much.
Thank you.
Okay. You're welcome.
Yeah.